Welcome to the latest episode of the DebtWired podcast. I'm David Orbai-Graves, senior reporter with DebtWire Europe, and I'm delighted to be joined by Gijs de Ruwer, managing director in Houlihan Lokey's financial restructuring group. Gijs has more than 25 years of investment banking experience and advised on numerous landmark restructuring deals, including Agricore, Endemol, and Virgin Atlantic, among many others. Today, we'll be delving into the thorny subject of creditor-on-creditor violence, a topic that just about everyone involved in the European credit markets is thinking and frequently worrying about. Gijs, when we spoke before, you asked the question, what protections are left? And I'm guessing the answer is not many. Can you offer a quick recap on how we've ended up where we have? Is it just a case of deteriorating credit documents, or did legislative change play into the situation too?
Thanks, David. And I'm as delighted as you are. So thank you for the opportunity. When we talked about protections, what we mean is the contractual safeguards for creditors in loans and bond documents, things like covenants, transfer restrictions, voting thresholds, and the like. Now, these protections are not static. They ebb and flow, and they ebb and flow with the supply and demand for credit. In bank-led loans of the past, and I think the last century, negotiating leverage sat with the lenders and even with individual banks. I think of the all affected lenders language. So documents were much tighter. Bonds that were arranged by underwriters, and still are, traditionally offered less protection because of the more dispersed holder base. But after the dot-com bust, easy monetary policy, and the rise of CLOs, this brought a wall of money. Think of that as a lot of supply. And as this supply outstripped demand, the terms loosened. And that briefly reversed during the great financial crisis. But then the central banks, now all of them, not just the Fed, loosened again through the 2010s into the 2020s, and especially during COVID. And that means today, loan terms often don't look much different from bond terms, and protection are near cycle lows. So typically, the only time documents get a meaningful tightening is after something has gone wrong, i.e. a breach, and then we're already in a restructuring. But that's a little bit closing the stable door after the horse has bolted.
Who do you think the biggest winners and losers are from the rise in creditor-on-creditor violence that stems from the kind of deteriorating protections? Is it as simple as saying aggressive hedge funds are making outsized gains at the expense of CLOs and real money investors who can't defend themselves? And I'd also be interested if more broadly, if you actually think this is actually problematic for the market to have this kind of creditor-on-creditor violence.
Before we consider who wins or loses from creditor-on-creditor violence, it makes sense to first consider what provided the opportunity for that kind of violence. And generally, this opportunity arises because either a borrower needs some additional liquidity or the borrower's capital structure is not sustainable, but is not yet causing a default. And then a transaction to address these issues could either be allowed under the credit agreement because the protections are weak and have left too much room, or if the creditors need to consent to adjust the remaining creditor protections, that amendment of a creditor agreement. And therefore, the first winner in these situations, when this opportunity arises, is the borrower, because it gets extra cash or extra runway. And if the transaction doesn't result in a lender-led restructuring, it is the sponsor. And they collectively win at the expense of the creditors as a whole, who are therefore then the losers. Now, if you do not require any creditor consent, the borrower and the sponsor have all discretion to choose a counterparty if they need one amongst their creditors or a third party. And that's not really creditor on creditor violence. That's more borrower or borrower sponsor on creditor violence. If on the other hand, the consent of every single creditor would be required, then there's also no creditor on creditor violence, because any single creditor could then block the transaction. So what we're talking about here is when any transaction that requires less than all the lenders, so let's say 75% or more usual and old loan documents, two-thirds, or very common these days, 50%, then the transaction becomes feasible without most of the lenders, and that creates an opportunity to leave other creditors behind. Now, who are then the winners? It's the ones who, of course, make sure that transaction can effectively take place, the bare minimum for that required consent if it is necessary. And the losers are the ones that are surplus to requirements and not invited to take part. Now, the risk of this not least because the borrower's directors have some duties for fairness. But if they really need the money and they need it urgently, that might trump the fairness across all creditors. So there's a higher risk of creating winners and losers if there is new money involved. You asked the second part of that question, is it problematic for the market? I think your use of the word market is interesting because I would define a market as a place where something is exchanged between parties as a function of supply and demand. Here we go again. And a market is therefore by definition dynamic and will adjust to circumstances. You would anticipate that creditors benefiting at the expense of other creditors is not what participants expected when they entered in that credit agreement. And you would expect the market to adjust either by better creditor protections or by higher pricing to compensate.
And many of the companies that are currently going through a restructuring or going through liability management exercises issued debt at the top of the market, as you noted before, rates shot up. Now we're in a slightly higher rates environment, and I'm not convinced that investor protections are actually improving that much. Do you see the trend reversing at any point? Will there be a catalyst for a reversal in terms of improving creditor protections?
We may actually still be climbing to the top of the market. Yes, I feel the same about the lack of improvement to new deal or returning deal creditor protections. It remains a function of supply and demand. Supply is still rampant. Prior to the summer, there was talk of 40 open CLO warehouses. And on the other hand, you have the Trump tariff and general economic environment uncertainty dampening the demand. There is still that imbalance. So I don't see that trend yet reversing. If LME, and in particular creditor on creditor violence or creditor abuse continues, possibly there would be a market participant pushback. And you see this occasionally in syndications that prove more challenging than initially anticipated. For example, at the time of Accel in summer 22, Lipton, perhaps also Cookware, that needed to concede a covenant.
And aside from improving the documents, I guess there's a potential also for legislative or legal changes that might improve the situation. And I'm thinking in particular at this point about some of the points that were raised on the issue of fairness in the English Court of Appeals judgment on Petrofac recently. Do you think that will do anything to restrain creditor on creditor violence? Or do you think you'll just end up with kind of forum shopping or people looking to do out-of-court LMEs alternatively?
Now, I think there's a nuance and a difference between the two, because much of the creditor on creditor violence will not need a court, because generally the required consent levels in the credit agreements are below those required for a court-sanctioned transaction. So where you do need a court is where you want to cram down other classes of creditors, and this is really nothing new. Rather than being creditor on creditor violence within claims that are pari or the same, this is violence between perhaps a secured creditor over an unsecured creditor. And that's very different. And that's also what parties expected when they got into the credit agreement. It is a different kind of violence, perhaps, and therefore is not the same. In terms of what Petrofac means on that, that was, of course, to cram down creditors. The court points there to requiring more market evidence of what many stakeholders in a transaction actually already anticipated and agreed, i.e., we kind of agree that the value breaks into a certain layer of debt. We don't need necessarily a market test to prove that point. Or we already know that no sane third party will provide anything economic in terms of new money, and we have to do it ourselves as incumbent creditors.
As you mentioned there, one of the points raised in Petrofac was that new money should be accompanied by market testing exercise or expert evidence that the new money is on market terms. You just mentioned that it's kind of known to the parties involved that no third party would be willing to participate in new money often. But do you think this means that the court will need additional evidence to demonstrate that? If so, what kind of opportunities does that perhaps open up for financial advisors such as yourself? Or indeed, if there are more kind of thorough market testing exercises, could we see kind of increased participation of third-party investors in rescue financing?
No, it is interesting, of course, not least because gathering this evidence is generally a job for a financial advisor. So I am cheering that. Hopefully, we also get to charge for it. I'm not sure whether it leads to more third-party participants, because an RP or many European processes, all effectively on the basis of the second European restructuring directive, you cannot prime creditors, incumbent creditors, without their consent. So it differs materially from Chapter 11 and DIP financing, where you can prime all incumbent claims. Because you can't prime, this is also why historically incumbent lenders that will consider not just the terms of the new money, but also the implications of that new money on the claims they already held in the structure, have been generally the providers of new money. And these parties would also not easily provide consent to be primed by a third party. So that makes me believe that there will not be necessarily more third-party participation in these kind of restructuring connected financings.
When we spoke previously, you contrasted the UK restructuring plan against the Dutch war and noted that these two processes can lead to quite different outcomes for secured creditors. Perhaps you can unpack that a bit and talk about what, in your view, works well and what doesn't work so well in these different processes.
Both the UK RP and the Dutch BOA are the respective UK and Dutch interpretations of the second European restructuring directive that was negotiated for years following the great financial crisis and when the UK was still a member of the EU. Now, the second European restructuring directive aims for a fair distribution of the restructured value amongst creditors. And the restructured value, i.e. the new steady state, may leave value to creditors lower down the waterfall because secured creditors only receive what their collateral is worth. And the remainder of their claim, i.e. beyond the collateral, the uncovered part, shares pro rata with unsecured creditors. Now, the interpretation of what collateral is worth could be different. In the UK, the comparator is moving towards the alternative transaction, whatever that may be. It may be a fire sale. In the Netherlands, the comparator is liquidation by law. Given that liquidation is less likely or more likely to result in less value than any alternative transaction, Dutch secured creditors get less value allocated outright by virtue of their collateral and will have to share more with the unsecured creditors than a UK secured creditor would.
Lastly, I'd like to ask you about CDS, which often seems like the invisible elephant in the room during restructuring negotiations. What difficulties are created when you're negotiating with a party whose incentives may be skewed by an undisclosed CDS position? And do you think that CDS positions should be routinely disclosed to ensure fairer dealing?
CDSs are the invisible elephant because these are private bilateral contracts. So nobody else's business, and that's why you generally don't have an insight in them. They were more prevalent, let's say, further back than a time you didn't hear much of them, and more recently you see them popping back up, generally in the context of larger transactions, logically. Yes, they could skew negotiations because you have, let's say, two parties at the table. One holds a material claim without credit insurance and therefore bears the full economic consequence of the outcome of negotiation. And another party with perhaps the same material claim, but full credit insurance, sits at the table and negotiates without any economic consequence whatsoever. Provided, of course, that the insurance policy will eventually pay, which is not necessarily given these days. So the second party that's fully insured will negotiate for his CDS rather than his incumbent claim. And that could lead to steering that negotiation in a different way than an ordinary incumbent claim holder would. Now, it's not uncommon. And if you had known about it, it all becomes clear on why people want certain things. And I think generally, you resolve that because you eventually figure it out on why do people choose a certain route. Clearly, if there would be a public disclosure, perhaps not dissimilar to having to disclose short equity positions if you are holding them, would make all much simpler. But generally, in transactions, you figure this out along the way. And if indeed CDS is material, generally there are certain parts that you would need to think of in structuring your transaction to make sure that there's nothing unexpected happening with regards to the CDS or the trigger event.
A lot to consider there, Heist. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts today. This has been the DebtWired podcast with our guest Heist de Ruiver from Houlihan Lokey. Please do subscribe to receive all the latest insights from the DebtWire team.